So today, when you're leaving, make sure you grab one of those bottles. Great thing to do with the kids, too, and get them and tell them the story about saving lives, not just physically, but even spiritually. People come to Christ through First Coast Women's Services. Today, we continue our series called You Asked For It, and my good friend Caleb Kaltenbach is here, and he's going to tell you his story, and he's going to share with you how in the world we use grace and compassion as we have these really kind of hard topics in our society. And I'm telling you, I'm so excited about hearing what God has to say through Caleb Kaltenbach this morning. Will you guys give it up for Caleb right now? Give it up for him.
Hey, hey, how are we doing today? Good? Hey, hey, how are we doing today? Good? All right. I was going to say, you just got done singing songs to the creator of the universe, so yeah, don't go, nah. Okay. It's not like your first day of school or whatever. Hey, I am so glad to be with you. Nathan just said, by the way, do you love Nathan and the staff here and the team? You've got a great team here. Like, if I lived here, this is the church that I would attend. So if you're brand new today, somebody invited you here, and then you saw the subject of what we're talking about, you're like, okay, well, you owe me breakfast, like, for the next 2 weeks. Or maybe you thought she was cute and you pulled her in here in a non-stalker type way. Whatever it was that brought you here, if you're just kicking the tires, looking underneath the hood, trying to learn more, trying to see if this is where you want to park, this is a place where it's okay to not be okay, but we all link arms and we try to follow Jesus together, no matter what we're going through. So do me a favor, look at the person next to you in a non-creepy way. Don't look behind you, because there's no way to make that not non-creepy. But just look around. Some of you are not looking around. It's bothering me right now. I have ADHD, I can tell. Look at left and right. See all these people? They're pretty messed up, all of them. You're like, wow, welcome to church. Thanks, Caleb. No, but it's serious. It's serious. You know, human beings, like, I don't think they make the best decisions in the world. Have you ever noticed that? That people don't make very good decisions. I really believe that. Case in point, I live in Los Angeles. I don't know if that was a good decision. You know, I'm still kind of on West Coast time. God is still asleep on the West Coast. He's awake over here. But over there, he's still asleep. But seriously, I fly a lot for what I do. I'm on staff at a church out there, sister church to River Christian Church, called Shepherd Church or Shepherd of the Hills Church out in the Los Angeles area. And I also consult with a lot of churches and ministries and schools, so I fly a lot. And if you ever question whether or not people make good decisions, and you think, no, people make great decisions. Not true. Go to an airport. Go to an airport. Okay? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I'm not joking about this, okay? Things happen to me all the time. I always am putting stuff on Instagram about things that happen on airplanes and in the airports. Like, one time we were delayed because the captain said, well, ladies and gentlemen, we would be taking off, but unfortunately, they put the fuel in the wrong tank. Those crazy guys. Rang my call button. I'm surprised I was the only one. The flight attendant came by, said, may I help you? I said, where did they put it? She's like, put what? The fuel. Well, I can't tell you that. What? Seriously, it makes no sense. So this one time, we were taken off. We had reached cruising altitude. I was going to Kansas City, L.A. to Kansas City, the home of the greatest NFL football team in the world. And we had reached cruising altitude. And I'm in the aisle seat, best place to sit. You can escape quickly if you need to that way, right? Homegirl next to me, some middle-aged, God bless her, lady, takes off her shoes and socks and starts clipping her toenails right next to me, like a wood chipper. I usually don't say anything. Even though I am German, I usually don't. I just looked at her and I said, really? Seriously? And she said, is this bothering you? I said, your toenail is on my shoe. I said, it was not there a couple minutes ago. She said, well, I guess I could do this at home when I get home tonight. I said, let's go with that plan. I'm a big fan. I said, as a matter of fact, That's when I clipped my toenails at home by myself. I said, I've been married to my wife since 2004. She has not seen me clip my toenails once in all of marriage. And the lady's like, huh, I'll try that. People don't make good decisions because people are messed up. And I could give you illustration after illustration, but I don't need to give you illustration after illustration. You already know. You lived through 2020. You lived through 2021. You lived through your whole life. You don't make very good decisions on your own. You make some good decisions, but that's one of the things that we believe, that if you follow Jesus, you have to repent, and you have to admit to everybody that you're not very good at making decisions, right? Now, it doesn't mean that you can't make some good decisions, but it usually means that you don't make very good decisions. Here's what I really believe. Here's what I really believe, okay? I believe that people are messy. I believe if you're a Homo sapien, you got issues. By the way, Homo sapien, that is a biological term, people, for human being. If you're not a Homo sapien, talk to me afterwards. I have questions. But if you are a person, you have issues, I have issues, and we are messy. And you see this in how we categorize people, how we define people falsely, how we put labels on people when they don't need labels, but yet we label them so it's easier for us to decide whether or not we want to invest in them or just like go right over them. And we can just say, well, they're part of that group, they're part of that group. And we don't spend time getting to know people. Here's my question today. How do you love messy people? How do you love people that are not like you? How do you love people that are in different kind of relationships that you don't understand? How do you love people that vote differently? How do you love people that watch that news station? I used to watch news, and I found myself getting upset. I don't watch the news anymore. I watch Unsolved Mysteries. I'm not upset. Now I'm just scared all the time. But how do you love people that work for that organization, live in that part of town, that have this opinion, that has this theology, that their ethic is this way, and you don't understand that? How do you love people like that? That's what we're going to take a look at today, okay? So in just a minute, we're going to be in John chapter 8. Not yet. We're going to have the words on the screen in just a second. But basically, you can turn there and get ready in your Bibles, your mobile devices. Let me just set the scene for you. If you're not used to going to church, that is the fourth book of the New Testament, okay? It's written by one of his 12 students. He actually had more than 12, but one of the main 12. Actually, John was probably his favorite student. Jesus really didn't have favorites, but he really liked him, okay, and really invested a lot in John. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the first three Gospels are very much alike, and when John wrote his Gospel, he kind of undertook to write more of a spiritual account of Jesus' life. That's why some of you are like, I love John, I love doing my devotional about John, this is so great. I don't know why I'm like that. It's early in the morning. I don't know why I'm making fun of you for doing devotionals out of John. Just keep up with me, people. It's going to be a long morning if you can't keep up with that, okay? So basically, John records things that nobody else records. And so he records this really interesting circumstance in Jesus' life. And it's not like there's a non-interesting circumstance in Jesus' life. But let's go ahead and turn to John chapter 8, beginning in verse 2. And if you don't have your mobile device or, you know, your Bibles, that's fine, because we're going to have the words on the screen here, and I'm going to read for you. And we're going to read through the middle. We're going to stop right in the middle of verse 6, okay? John 8, 2. At dawn, he, Jesus, appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say? We're going to stop in the middle of verse 6, but the first part of verse 6, it drives me crazy. They were using this as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. Now, let's just set the scene. I'm not going to assume that everybody in here knows who all these different characters are. Back in the first century, you had people who were Pharisees. You had some 6,000 people in Judea who were Pharisees. These were the popular synagogue leaders of the day. If they were alive today, you'd be listening to their podcasts, reading their books. These were kind of like the celebrities. And then you had the teachers of the law. These were like the seminary professors. They had like 3 PhDs. They didn't have a life. They were 70 years old, still living with their parents in the basement of their parents' house. That's who these people were, okay? And they hated Jesus. Because John chapter 1, verses 14 and 17 say that Jesus came full of both grace and truth, compassion and conviction. Mercy and principle. And yet they led from a perspective of fear and legalism. Because if you ever want to run for public office, political office, here's a tip for you. If you want to win, or if you want to try to win, here's what you do. Try to get people to be afraid. Because when you can get people to be afraid, you can control them. People who are fearful are easy to control. Because they don't want to be fearful anymore. And so Jesus comes and he offers them clean water, a different choice. And so they're like, we got to get rid of this guy, because if we don't get rid of this guy, he's going to take our place. And we don't want to lose our power. We don't want to lose our influence. So they find this woman who is caught in the act of adultery. In the act. Did you catch that? In the act. In the act. The present act. You're like, how do they do that? I'm like, I don't know. They're creepers, right? And they catch her, and they drag her through town, humiliating her. And they take her, and they put her before Jesus. And they're like, teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. And I'm like, where's the dude? He's not there. And if you go to Deuteronomy 22, God does say in the Old Testament that if you find a man and a woman caught in the act of adultery, they're supposed to have a trial, they're supposed to be witnesses, and then if they're found guilty, you can take them outside the city gates and stone them. Now, again, that was a different time, different circumstances, but they haven't had a trial, there are no witnesses, and there's no dude. I guess she was having an affair by herself. He got a get-out-of-jail-free card, right? And I guess what really makes me mad about this is that it proves that these religious leaders don't care about her. They don't care about what she's been through. They don't care about anything. They are using her as much as the man who's having an affair with her was using her in that moment. Now, if you're not used to reading the Bibles, let me just tell you something. You don't want to get snarky with Jesus. He don't like that. And believe me, you never want to get in an argument with Jesus. There are just some people you don't want to get in an argument with. Yoda and Jesus. Yoda, who's not real, and Jesus Christ. You don't want to get in an argument. There's no danger of getting in an argument with a fictitious thing. But Jesus was real. He still is alive today. But Jesus does something weird in the end of verse 6. And some people are like, Caleb, don't call what Jesus does weird. It is weird. I didn't say it was creepy, bad, strange. But if you don't think that it's weird, it's because you've read this story too many times. You need to act like you're reading this story again. Look at the rest of verse 6. Here's how Jesus responded to them. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. That's an awkward response. So I'm like, no, it's not. Okay, fine. When was the last time you were in an argument with somebody and you got upset and you're like, hold on. I tried it with my wife the other day. Fellas, I do not recommend. We're arguing about something. I was losing the argument, as usual. Bent down, started writing on the ground. She's like, what are you doing? I said, trying to act like Jesus. I figured one of us should. I did not say that. My wife is a fiery Latina. I would not be up here right now. I would be on Unsolved Mysteries. With the creepy music playing underneath. Hey, where is Caleb? She's like, I don't know. And so a lot of scholars try to figure out what in the world was Jesus writing? Was he writing the sins of the people? Was he writing down verses? I found this really interesting passage all the way back in the Old Testament. See if you can make the connection. Jeremiah 17, 13, it says this. Lord, you are the hope of Israel. All who forsake you will be put to shame, and those who turn away from you will be written in the dust. Or in the original Hebrew, that could be the sand, the dirt, the ground, the mud. Why? Because they have forsaken the Lord, the spring of living water. Not the woman caught in adultery. And I'm not giving her a free pass with adultery. No, she's sinned still. But still, she's closer to God than the people that think they know God. And I think they knew exactly what Jesus was doing. That's just my opinion. Like, if we're in Vegas and you didn't know I was betting, I would bet all in that Jesus is writing down their names. But they don't get it, because who really gets it at first when you hold the mirror up to somebody? Look at verse 7. Look at verse 7 right here. John 8, verse 7. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up to them and said, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to cast a stone at her." And again, he stooped down, he wrote on the ground. Now, this is brilliant. Jesus said, "Hey, any one of you without sin, cast a stone." He knew that nobody in that crowd was going to cast a stone for a couple reasons. Number one, they believed back then, just like I believe, just like the leadership of your church believes, that God is the only sinless being in existence. And so if they picked up a rock and threw it, they would be claiming to be sinless. Okay? That's called lying. It's a big one. Right? I mean, there are 613 commands that make up the law in the Old Testament. God thought lying was a big enough deal, he put it in the top 10. Why? Because lying damages the relationship, right? But then he also knew that they weren't going to throw a stone, because if they picked up a stone claiming to be sinless, that very stone that they threw would be used to throw right back at them. Why? Because God is the only sinless being in existence. If they threw a rock claiming to be sinless, they would be claiming to be God. And that is blasphemy. And that is punishable by the death penalty like that. And now they're afraid. I tell people all the time, you may not believe in Jesus yet, but you got to admit, he's got style. He's got mad skills. You do not want to get in an argument with Jesus. And I love this. Take a look at this. Verse 9, going through the end of the story. This is great. I love this. This is actually funny. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Like, she has had a day and a half right here in less than an hour. And it says in verse 10, Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. And right here at the end of verse 11, this is the reason, this is how we love people who are different from us. This is how you love the people that are in relationships you can't understand, that have ideas about life that you don't understand, that perceive themselves in ways that you don't understand. This is how you love them. Here's what Jesus says. It's one long sentence in the original language. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Grace, neither do I condemn you. Truth, leave your life of sin. As a matter of fact, just like I quoted earlier, John chapter 1, verses 14 and 17 say that Jesus Christ came full of both grace and truth at the same time. Okay? Now, you might be saying, well, he's Jesus. He can do that. Yeah, maybe, but he still had a human experience. Let me just let you know, human beings don't make good decisions. They are messy. They are messed up. To some degree, everybody's a moron, and we all need Jesus, right? If we weren't morons, we wouldn't need Jesus. And so, when you think about it, we lean either one way or another. As a matter of fact, I could divide the room of people who are listening to me live right now, or listening or watching after the fact, into two different groups. You're either more about the grace, more about the truth. You're more about the mercy. You're more about the principle. Some of you are like my kids when we play Monopoly. Rules, merely suggestions. Until you start losing. Then you got to pull out the rule book and you can make new ones. Or some of you are like my wife. Love my wife. Love her to death. But play a game. She's like, now let's all read through the rule book together. Okay? Rules control the fun. Rules make fun more fun. And then I'm like, wow, this is so fun. I may have to skip out on the game. I mean, one can only have so much fun today and reading the rule book. Whoa, that's just, I got to be careful not take the fun for everybody else in the world. But here's the deal. I'm going to make this statement. Some of you might be offended, and if you are, I'm sorry. But, I mean, it's the truth, and some of you will be like, yeah, it's true. But here's the deal. If you take sides between grace and truth, like you're saved, see in heaven. But here's the deal. You're not a mature Christian. You're not acting Christ-like. If Jesus came full of both grace and truth, what gives you the right to just be all about the grace and no truth, or all about the truth and no grace? You don't get that liberty. Who are you? Who are you? You don't get that liberty. You're not that important where you get to make that decision. You're like, whoa, it was okay for Jesus, but then I arrived on the scene. No. You know what it's like? If you're just all about the grace and no truth, it's like holding a rubber band by one side. You ever see somebody just walking around holding a rubber band like this? No. You know why? Because it's annoying, right? Serves no purpose. This is what when it's all about the grace and no truth. When you're all about the truth and no grace, same thing. It's annoying. There's no power here. No purpose. So where's the purpose? Where's the power? Well, if you say, I'm about the grace and the truth, where does the power lie? The power lies in the tension of the two. And you know why people don't want to live in the tension of grace and truth? Because tension is uncomfortable. And we are a bunch of divas. And we want to be comfortable. That's why it is spiritually lazy to be all about the grace or all about the truth, because that's your muscle habit. It takes no faith or dependence on God for you to go back to your muscle habit. It takes all of the strength in the world to stretch over to the grace side or to stretch over to the truth side. And when you run away from this tension, there's a name for it. It's love. You're running away from love, because I believe that love is the tension that we feel between grace and truth. Love is the tension of grace and truth. Because love is sacrificial all the time. And by the way, if you don't agree with what I'm saying about tension in Christianity, you might want to find a different religion. Because Christianity may not be for you. You're like, Caleb, I don't think that's in the script. I don't think you can say that. Okay? Let me show you. You have tension all over your faith. You just don't realize it. Like, we believe in one God, but the Trinity. Hello, people. Tension, right? Let me try that again. Tension, right? I'm looking for a response. Tension, right? Thank you. Yeah, some of you got it. He's going to keep saying this until I say right. Jesus was fully God and fully human. The Bible was inspired of God, written by people. God is in control, allows us to have free will. Death and evil were defeated at the cross and the resurrection, not yet destroyed. Right? The virgin birth. You ever read Revelation? The wrath of the Lamb. Okay? You can be a good preacher and still have hair. Tension. All over our faith. But why do we not stay up all night worrying about the Trinity, but we run away from grace and truth? I'll tell you why. Grace and truth always has to do with your relationships. Relationships have emotional attachments. That's why you haven't stayed up all night worrying about Jesus being fully God and fully human. You have stayed up all night worrying about somebody you love or mourning the loss of someone. And we run away from emotional tension, from emotional pain. That's why we take sides between grace and truth. So who's the messy person you need to live with in your life? And I got to go quick here because I can already tell I'm going to be over time. I want to honor my time, and I want Jesus to be happy with me. And anyway, so here's the deal. Originally from Kansas City in Columbia, Missouri. And when I was 2 years old, my parents divorced, and they both went into same-sex relationships when I was two. My mom met a psychologist and moved to Kansas City, where my mom worked at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. My dad taught, stayed in Columbia, Missouri, which is 2 hours away from Kansas City. He taught at Stevens College, philosophy, law, and rhetoric. He also taught at the University of Missouri, Columbia. And I was raised my whole life in the LGBTQ community in Kansas City and Columbia. And my three gay parents were activists. My mom and her partner were on the board of directors at GLAAD. Board of Directors, GLAAD Kansas City. When I was in preschool, elementary age, middle school, I grew up with my parents taking me to pride parades and campouts, house parties, events, and I saw the ugliness of Christians. I remember, like, I was 9 or 10 or whatever, marching in this parade, and at the end of the parade, there are all these Christians saying, "God hates you. No room for you." And when people from my mom's parade would go try to talk to them, these so-called Christians would spray them with water and urine, saying, "This is what Jesus thinks of you." I saw my mom's friends, young men who were dying of AIDS, whose Christian families either ignored them or when they visited them, wouldn't talk to them, wouldn't touch them. They would just make an appearance and leave because they were making a righteous appearance. They were making a moral stand. You know, there's a difference between being a moral and being a moron. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen somebody die from AIDS. It is awful. And each time I would ask my mom, "Mom, why are they acting like that?" And she said, and she would tell me, "Caleb, they are Christians. Christians hate gay people. If you're not like them, they will not like you." And I thought to myself, man, I never want to be one of those. Because if Christians are this bad, I can't imagine how awful Jesus Christ is. That was my thinking. And so by the time I got to be 16, I was living it up. I had hair all the way down to here. Like, wow, that was funny. I'm just kidding. It was funny. I was also thinner, and the Lord taketh away and addeth. Believe it or not, I used to be on the swim team. We're going to leave that alone. I miss those days. Anyway, lots of life has happened since then. So I got invited when I was 16 to go to a Bible study led by a Christian who was a high schooler. And it was four other high schoolers, and I was 16. I thought, I'm going to go and be a ninja Christian, pretend to be a Christian, and dismantle their faith. And I went there, and real good plan, right? Didn't work out that way. I walked in the house, like, it looked like they had raided a Bible bookstore. At the age of 16, I had never really stepped foot in a conservative Christian household, much less a Catholic household. I walked in, they had Christian breath mints. Do you guys know we have our own breath mints? They're called testaments. You don't get it, just Google it afterwards. Not now. Okay? Don't do it now. Okay, they had the Christian bookstore pictures on the wall, the paintings. And I looked at them and I'm like, why do these people have framed pictures of animals they don't own on the wall? Like a sheep and a lion with Bible verses. I had never seen that. Never seen somebody have a framed picture of a sheep on the wall. And then my friend comes up from the basement and says, we've circled up downstairs. Won't you join us? And I'm like, well, this is the beginning of a horror movie. And went downstairs. Everybody's reading from 1 Corinthians. I couldn't find it because I don't know, God gave us a table of contents at that time. I found 1 Chronicles. I'm like, nobody will be able to tell who reads the Bible. They all read from 1 Corinthians. I read a verse from 1 Chronicles about some dude getting impaled. And they're like, where are you? And I said, well, I'm in 1 Chronicles. They're like, oh, you're in the Old Testament. I'm like, so is there a new one? I didn't know we had updated 2.0. But the more I kept going, the more I realized that Jesus actually had very, very deep relationships with people. That he had deep theological convictions. He had very real expectations of how his followers should live their lives, pursue holiness, and treat other people. But he also had very authentic relationships with people who were nothing like him. And I love how Pastor Andy Stanley at North Point Church in Atlanta says this, that people who are nothing like Jesus liked Jesus, and he liked them back. And I started to like Jesus. And I'm like, I love Jesus. Honestly, I don't want a sheep picture. Other than that, I love Jesus. And so then I started really praying about, okay, you know, what does the Bible have to say about sexuality? I knew that I would have to come to terms with this. So I came to two conclusions that I still hold today. You know, the first one is this, that I believe that God designed sex to be expressed in a marriage between a man and a woman. Here's what else I believe. That theological convictions are never catalysts to devalue another human being. That your biblical beliefs should never be the basis of which you sideline somebody or marginalize another person. Because if they are, and how you treat them and love them, I don't know what Frankenstein version of Jesus you're following is not the real one. Am I saying you have to agree with people? No, you don't have to agree, but you don't get the right to mistreat people. And I think we should all agree with that, especially if we follow Jesus. If you don't, I'll give you Pastor Nathan's cell phone. You can call him at 3 in the morning, ask him, okay? And so then I call my friend Greg. I've been going to his dad's church in the evening for youth group, and I said one morning, Greg, I've turned Christian. Like, I don't know what to do now. He's like, well, let's go eat Chinese food and I'll baptize you. We did that. This is in Acts 2:38, 2:37, somewhere, 2:37 and a half. And so he explained the Romans Road. He explained Acts 2:37, 2:38, 2:39 to me. We got baptized. I went and came out to my three activist gay parents at the age of 16 as a Christian, and they kicked me out of the house. You're like, how did that happen? Well, it was easy. Okay? They were afraid. Here's some principles I need to go over with you real quick, okay? Here's some principles. Follow me on this, okay? Number one, don't allow fear from some people to determine the value of many people. Do not allow fear from some people to determine the value of many people. You say, Caleb, what do you mean by this? Because the fear of some can lead you to really not like the many. And our society feels like it's run by extremists. And you know what? They have a lot of influence. But extremists are less than 10% of our society on both sides of the aisle, quote unquote. And I know that's too simplistic. There are other kind of extremists. But for sake of time, like, small amount. They try to get you to be afraid. And guess what? Fear is not a bad thing. You ever heard somebody in a leadership seminar? Well, you know, fear is a bad thing. Those people are morons. No. Fear is a good thing. If you're hiking and if you see a mountain lion, you should be afraid. God gave you the capacity to feel fear for a reason, people. If you're hiking and you see a rattlesnake, you're like, well, I'm going to name it Carla and I'm going to put a collar on it and you'll pet it and cuddle it. No, you're going to be dead. You're going to get up to heaven and God's going to do a face palm right when you get up there. It's like you had every opportunity and you named it Carla. Carla's a great name, by the way. But you don't pick up a rattlesnake. Fear's not a bad thing. But when fear begins to control the direction of your life and the direction of your relationships, fear is toxic. That's what I mean. Don't allow the fear of some. See, the Pharisees were afraid of losing their place in society. They were afraid of people like this woman having influence. And Jesus is like, I'm not afraid. I'm going to engage it. Okay? Here's the second thing you need to do. Think deeper about people, not differently about theology. I'm inviting you to think deeper about people. I'm not asking you to think differently about theology. You're like, what do you mean by that? I think you should keep what you believe the Bible says about marriage or sex. Or marriage and sex, both. Keep them both, okay? But I want you to think deeper about people. Because nobody is shallow, everybody has depth, and everybody is an amalgam of all their hopes and their dreams and their failures and their relationships and their upbringings and their opinions and the things that they struggle with, the issues, the disorders, the broken relationships, the unhealthy negative talk they have in their own head, the bad committee in the back of the head, or maybe they think too much of themselves. Everybody is broken. There's not one person who isn't broken in every aspect. Every single person alive is sexually broken. Every single person alive is relationally broken. Okay? I want you to think deeper about people. I don't want you to think differently about theology. This whole idea of love is intentional, grace and truth, here's another thing that you put into practice, okay? Embrace the difference between acceptance and agreement. Embrace the difference between acceptance and agreement. Acceptance means you love people where they are, for who they are, no matter what. That's acceptance. You're actually called by Jesus to do that. If you follow Jesus, you don't get a chance, you don't get a choice as to whether or not you want to be loving. You don't get a choice as to whether or not you want to forgive. You have to. But that doesn't mean, praise God, you have to agree with every single political opinion, relational decision, worldview, or whatever else that somebody has. acceptance, not agreement. You are not called to agree with everybody. You must accept everyone. Real quick, I went to Bible college in Southern Missouri and then got out of there real quick because all the family trees just go straight up. They don't branch out. It's like one pole going straight up right there in Southern Missouri. Moved out to Los Angeles back in 1999 when it was popular to do so. And started working at a church that I work at now. Worked there for 11 years, now I'm back on staff. But when I was at Shepherd Church, got married to my beautiful, muy caliente wife, Amy. And in her wildest dreams, she had no idea that her knight in shining armor would look like a cross between Gru, Uncle Fester, Dr. Evil, and Charlie Brown. She is a lucky lady. This is her eye candy she wakes up to every morning. I told her, you better hope nothing ever happens to me because husband number two, it's not going to look this good. Not going to look this good. So just get ready, honey. She's like, thanks. We have two kids. My son, who's actually here with me this weekend, Joel is 15, my daughter 13. Back in 2010, I wanted to preach, so we moved to Dallas, Texas. And I was there for 3.5 years until we moved back to go pastor a church in Simi Valley, California, where I live now, a suburb of Los Angeles. And I went to go preach at this church. My parents moved down there separately from one another to be close to our family. And actually, they ended, believe it or not, they ended up attending the church I was preaching at, even though they knew that I believed what I believed about relationships and sexuality. And they're like, you're not going to preach on it all the time. I said, no, not all the time. I'm not a creeper, you know. Might be weird in other areas, not there. It's like, ugh. And so they came, and the church treated them well. Better than I did. Do you know how annoying it is when people treat your parents better than you do? You're like, you have no idea. These people are trying to get, it's just, never mind. Forget it. That's my own issue. So here's what's really cool. About 2 or 3 weeks before we left, okay, my parents at the ages of 69 gave their lives to Jesus Christ. At the ages of 69 and 70. And I asked my parents, what did it? Like I was expecting maybe a philosophical argument or something like that. I wasn't thinking deep enough. And in so many words, here's what they said. People treated us like people, not like projects. They just treated us like people. Not like some kind of evangelistic, you know, secret evangelistic ninja moves project. Treated them well. And I was like, wow. If you just treat people like people. Here's the last thing I want you to do, okay? Ask yourself, what am I willing to do to keep or build influence with? You fill in the blank right there. Whose name goes there? Because short of denying Jesus, short of sinning, I will do whatever I can to earn influence with somebody I love. And that means I'm risk being misinterpreted by Christians. I already get that all the time. I don't really care what other Christians think. I do care about the people I'm trying to lead to Jesus. And I will do whatever I can to earn influence. With my own kids, I will do whatever I can to earn the right to be the first person they text or call when life hits the bottom of the barrel. Grace isn't messy, but it looks messy. People are messy, but God loves messy people. Let me pray for you.